Sportsnet and Sportsnet 590 The Fan present Point Taken, a podcast connecting you to the sports and pop culture issues you care about and the guests you want to hear more from. Now, here's Carolyn Cameron and Greg Brady.
That's mostly accurate. This is the Point Taken podcast on sportsnet.ca, episode 5. My name's Greg Brady. You may know me from Brady and Price, Sportsnet starting lineup. There is no Carolyn Cameron for now. And when you hear her later in this podcast, she'll acknowledge A, it's episode 5, and B, she's not even in the city or province or time zone. She's in Vancouver, British Columbia. So we're going to go there. We got two guests on the West Coast this week. Dallas Eakins, former Edmonton Oilers coach, former Toronto Marlies coach, will join us. We have three guests in total. But Dallas is intriguing. I always found him interesting. I always enjoyed interviewing him because he seemed different. First of all, he's a fitness nut. And secondly, I didn't feel there was a... there's not the same filter. And there is a filter. But he would say interesting things that I thought other NHL coaches who fall into cliches would not say. And I think that works for him, no question, in terms of making him interesting. We'll find out from him whether he feels, either in Edmonton or any other stops, that he feels it ever worked against him. I think that's a reasonable question to ask. He's the current head coach of the San Diego Gulls. So he gets to live in San Diego. And they've been really good. They're the Anaheim Ducks AHL team. You may have noticed Brandon Montour and Shea Theodore stepped up, played big minutes for the Ducks in big playoff games. And, of course, Anaheim fell just a game short of going all the way to the Stanley Cup Final. They got out of their division, which is no easy task, getting out of the Pacific, where San Jose got out of last year to get to the final. And an older group, but there's been some great development in San Diego. Now, they call those players up. It's hard for the San Diego Gulls to advance in the postseason, often in the Calder Cup. And we'll ask them this. You lose players, your playoff chances are obviously dinged. They're going to take your best players. Guess what? They're going to do that. That's what the farm club is there for. It's like that in AAA baseball. You're not going to see always the best AAA collections of talent in the minor league baseball playoffs, or even a double A. But here, quite significant that players stepped up, played big minutes for a Ducks team that just had a lot of wounded bodies. So, yeah, Dallas is really interesting. Was head coach in Edmonton for a year and a bit. They were rolling through coaches pretty consistently. Safe to say they will keep Todd McLellan moving forward, but did the wheel just... Todd McLellan's a good coach, but I think Dallas Eakins is a good coach. Ralph Kruger's a good coach. Todd Nelson's a good coach. There's plenty of good coaches that have been in that scenario with the Oilers in a 10-year playoff drought, and the wheel just has to stop, and you got to find success at a certain point. So we'll talk to Dallas Eakins in just a little bit. J.D. Bunkus is going to join us as well from Sportsnet's Free Association podcast, which he co-hosts. This is one of our best podcasts, one of our most downloaded, one of our best, with Donovan Bennett, as they do an NBA podcast with the NBA wrapping up. I find the NBA offseason absolutely fascinating. So Golden State are the champs. I think they enhanced their rep as the best basketball team, or one of, ever. And in a weird way, LeBron James, in a very perfunctory way, enhanced his rep as the best basketball player on the planet that I've ever seen. You can admire Michael Jordan's mid-range game, how high he could dunk, how he played in big games, how bad he wanted it, how he was a jerk to his teammates to try and make them better. You can admire anything you want out of Michael Jordan, and you're 6-0 in the finals. If that's your argument, I got nothing. If you think 6-0 is the ultimate judge, I guess we can't have a discussion about LeBron James and his 8 finals, and probably 9, and probably 10, and maybe 11 over the next 4 or 5 years. When Michael Jordan was LeBron James's age right now, he was finishing his career with the Washington Wizards, okay? Or when he played his 14th season, I should say, because he was away for those couple seasons. LeBron just finished his 14th year, went to his 8th final, and has gone to the conference finals 11 of those 14 times. 11 of those 14 times. And yes, in basketball, I think we judge players more by their playoff accomplishments than hockey. Wayne Gretzky never got to a Stanley Cup final in his last 7 years. You don't give it a second thought. Mario Lemieux only played in two. Didn't play in any after 1992. We don't give it a second thought. We really wouldn't hammer Sidney Crosby if he had one cup. We'd say, could without those concussions, could have won a second, maybe could have won a third. Now he's got three. And why not four? Why not five? To quote LeBron James, Chris Bosh, and Dwayne Wade. So Dallas Aikens coming up basically right away. And we'll talk to J.D. Bunkus about the NBA. How this impacts the Raptors, too. A lot of diverse opinions on the finals. What you're thinking of your Masai Ujiri. What you're thinking of your Kyle Lowry. Because decisions get to be made by management, but they also get to be made by players. It's a strong, strong players union. The strongest, maybe, in all of organized sport. The cap has shot up exponentially. Players can get more than ever. You can't even remotely compare NBA salaries with any other North American sport. Maybe the top levels of international soccer and what guys are getting with weekly wages. I always hate that they lay it out by week. Tell me what the guy's getting paid per year. So all that, a reminder, we are on iTunes, we are on Google Play, we are on sportsnet.ca/590, so you can find the podcast there. Please do leave a review on iTunes. We're five episodes in. We're trying to spread things out, give you more content with less clutter than what radio sometimes is. I love radio, first love. Always will love it, always will be a fan of it, always will support it. But I can admit that we can stretch things out with interviews. And we've done that with Roberto Luongo. We did that with Matt Bonner last week from the San Antonio Spurs, ex of. And we'll continue to do that with the guests we're getting leading up to July, leading through August, and, of course, when the fall-winter sports start again. And interesting thoughts on – I have a thought later in the show I'll get to on the spreading out of the schedules. Maybe we'll approach that with Bunkus to some extent. And how everybody's complaining about the time of year these series end. Yet they lead us almost right into the draft. This year, you've got the added bonus in the NHL of the Vegas expansion draft. That's the first one in a decade and a half. We all were a lot younger when Columbus and Minnesota picked their teams to come into the NHL in the summer of 2000. Man, I mean, Nashville came in, then Atlanta, then Columbus and Minnesota together. Boom, we've got 30. And all we've had happen since then is Atlanta moved to Winnipeg. And Arizona almost moved 28 times. That's pretty remarkable. So that's all coming up next. First, we welcome in the head coach of the San Diego Gulls, former coach of the Toronto Marlies here. So a lot of the current Leafs he's coached, almost all the current Edmonton Oilers he's coached, because he finished there in the 2013-2014 season, and a ton of teams having been played for. He is Dallas Aikens. So it's great to get you on. People, I think, in Toronto remember you very fondly. They liked hearing your interviews. You were always an interesting news. I turn on Leafs TV, and I'm like, they could be playing the Manitoba Moose, or they could do that ridiculous 11-game trip, and when the boat show is here, and he's talking, and there's microphones, and he's got his hockey gloves and stick on, and I'd want to do that. Tell me what San Diego has been like for you in two seasons there. Just in terms of the media coverage, you see the same. You must develop a rapport you can't develop in a Toronto or Edmonton, Dallas.
Well, number one, thanks for having me. Mm. And number two, landing in here in San Diego has been such a blessing for me and my family. The answer to your question, though, is when we first showed up, there wasn't much. The rapport was very quick because it was basically one person. Hey, there's a pro hockey team in San Diego now. Let's go see what's going on. And we were up against, obviously, the Chargers and the Padres here in the market, along with a lot of university sports. But with wins and some excitement comes coverage. And the coverage has been real steady through the first season and then much more this season. It's not uncommon at the games now to have three or four cameras and three or four people asking questions, which is good for the American League. It's certainly not like a Toronto or an Edmonton where I've come through, but they're learning the game here. There are some of the people who understand the game, but it's fun. It's kind of like a mentorship for me to some of the media. to educate them on the game, and that's fun for me.
It's got some hockey heritage. I remember being a little kid, and the WHA was around, so I'd watch. The Toronto Toros were the first team I remember watching, with Mark Napier playing for them. And they play, God, they play Winnipeg, and Bobby Hall had the two Swedes with him. But there was a San Diego team. Do you have people come up to you and go, I'm old school, and they'd be old also, and the San Diego Mariners, I remember, or other San Diego hockey experiences. Do you get really traditional 4 or 5 decade fans that you've been able to speak to in 2 years?
Absolutely. And we do a lot of stuff here where we interact with our season ticket holders and our fan base. And our fan base is excellent. You know, we roll into these weekend games and we're anywhere from, you know, 10 to 12,000. And it's rocking in that same old arena that turned, I think it was this year, it turned 50 years old. And it's just a wonderful place to play. And you get those people who remember those times. And more recently, the old goals teams that were in here 10 and 12 and 15 years ago. Like, I played in the IHL.
Yeah.
And I remember, and it's all a blur, I remember staying at the hotel across the street from the rink when we came into play. I think I was playing for the Cincinnati Cyclones or someone. And I remember coming into that rink going, whoa, like there is some crazy fans in here. And that's the one thing that hasn't changed. Our fan base is a passionate one and a loud one.
I bet it is. Dallas Aikens is joining us, of course. We'll get to the Edmonton years. We'll get to the Toronto years as well. But you've done some winning there, too, the last 2 years. I think it's something to be proud of. The team has done really well in the regular season. And like last year, to some extent, Anaheim goes on a playoff run this year. A lot of injuries on the blue line, Kevin Bieksa notably. And as you're going into your playoffs, you lose a couple key players at least, don't you? Brandon Montour, who played, Shea Theodore, who played. People remember these guys. There's Montour's 22, Theodore's 21, and Randy Carlyle needed to get not just a few minutes, but good minutes from both those young players in Anaheim's run to the conference finals.
Well, yeah, and I'll go on 2 points there. Like, number one, to win in this league, in the American Hockey League, in the playoffs, you need two things to happen. And one is that you have to stay healthy. And that's no different than an NHL run. You've got to stay healthy if you're going to win it all in the end. And number two, it's almost imperative that your big club isn't playing. That they didn't make the playoffs, or they've been punted early in the playoffs, but because that makes sure that you have all of the players that you've been developing all year. And but the second part of it is that's what we're here for. You know, that's why Toronto has the Marlies, that's why Anaheim has the goals. Is our organizational goal as every NHL team is to win the Stanley Cup. And I always express to our players that, you know, we're practicing, we're playing to make sure we're ready to excel in that moment in a Stanley Cup final, not the Calder Cup final, the Stanley Cup final. That's why we're here. And we're really proud of the work we've done here over the last couple of years. It's obviously a quiet proudness. We've had players like Shea Theodore and Brandon Montour and Andre Passe and Nick Ritchie and John Gibson played for us 2 years ago. But we've been fortunate to have players that were really invested in their development and in their future. And when you've got players who are going to invest that time, you're able to steer them in the right direction, and the possibilities are endless for them.
And Anaheim, I think, you know, San Jose had a Joe Thornton playing on one leg. They couldn't replicate what they did last year. We had Bob Bugner on the podcast a few weeks ago. We had him on the morning show this week when he got the Florida job, and he said we were playing not very well at all. We go into the playoffs in 16. We get on a roll. It all comes together. Martin Jones is great for us. He goes, we felt awesome coming in this year. Then a couple weeks into the playoffs, we find out Joe Thornton's hurt. Brent Burns has had a great year, but he's a bit banged up, and they can't get past that Oilers team. Like the health is the health of the big clubs, especially with all you know what the Western travel is like in the NHL. It is very, very difficult. Like it like you said with Anaheim, I feel like they're a healthy body, a second healthy body away. And maybe we're talking about them as a cup champion. They were that good, and they played that well in the first two rounds.
Yeah, an extremely difficult team to play against Anaheim. Like, when you know, the game to me, when you're building the team, is, and you need the, for sure, two out of the three components. But if you have all three, then it's tough for the other team. And that's obviously your goaltending, your D, and who do you have down the middle? And the Ducks are strong down the middle. They've got an excellent D core. They have an excellent goalie. And Randy, maybe the toughest coach to coach against with his obsession with matchups. He grinds other coaches down. And, man, I really wish they would have stayed healthy. It would have been a great year for our whole organization. Still a successful one. But this organization here isn't looking to go to the conference final. They're looking to win cups.
There's a little bit of an element in Anaheim too of the Toronto band being back together. Dave Nonis works closely with Bob Murray. Randy is the head coach of Anaheim after Bruce Boudreau was let go last year. Now Bruce is in Minnesota. Randy gets that job. Randy wasn't sure he'd get back in. We'll talk about that with you in a little bit, but Randy was head coach. You're the AHL coach in Toronto. That relationship, if you will, is now there again. Is it different than it was in Toronto? What works? What doesn't about it with you and Randy? You won't agree on everything about players and systems, but what's it like?
Well, we coach differently, and we're comfortable with that. And I'll put, nothing's ever changed with Randy and I right from the first day he came into Toronto, because our relationship started way before then. I was a young player in the Winnipeg Jets organization. He was just finishing up his career. He had a profound effect on my career, taking the time with me and you know, guiding me and teaching me lessons about the game as a young player. And I never forgot that. You get people who come across you in hockey that you realize later on really had a positive effect and influence on you. And Randy was one of those guys to me. And so I've always admired him for that. Our friendship is a very close one. It was in Toronto, and it's continued on from right up until today. He coaches a certain way, and I believe in other things. There are certain players he likes and that I don't like. And that's the nature of it. We don't want a bunch of robots running through an organization. So I was excited for him. I was happy for him. Like he is an excellent coach. He's a great bench boss. I think he continues to evolve, and that bodes well for our organization. And with Dave Nonis, it's great too. Like I remember walking into the to talk to Bob Murray about this job, and walk Dave Nonis. I didn't even I wasn't even sure that he was here yet, and so he had just come on as well. And so it's interesting that everybody is kind of back together.
Let's flip this around then, because I was going to get to the Toronto stuff last, but you've raised some really intriguing points. Because yes, you're on that bench with Paul Maurice. The year I moved here after 9 years in Detroit was the 07-08 season, so that's Matz's last season, and that's the season of players not wanting to waive they're negotiated, that's their right, no movement clauses. And I'm not sure I've seen a team so criticized, for lack of a better term, as that one. That must have been, that seemed to wear Paul down. It seemed to wear Matz down. What are your recollections of Andrew Raycroft? Couldn't get in the net without getting booed. Vesa was, everyone seemed to just have a tough time. No one was thriving. And then what do you know, 6 months later, there's another man, you know, Brian Burke comes in, and it's all going to change. But what was that season like on the Leafs bench?
Well, I'll tell you what, we'll go to the year of all the guys not waiving their no trade clauses. And I remember a lot of stories being written, like it was kind of like a conspiracy that these guys were sticking together and they were, you know, going to stick the boots to the organization or whatever it was. And it wasn't that at all. Those guys had a true belief that this could be righted. Like they had a true belief that this could be righted. And I think it really showed the leadership of Matt and his effect on the team. And I was fortunate two ways with Matt. I played with Matt when I was a part-time player with the Leafs. So I got to see him in the room as a player, and then I got to coach him. But as soon as Matt said that he wasn't waving, all those other guys are going, "We're not leaving either. We're gonna stay here and fight the best we can." And that's all that was. There was nothing else there, and it was a group of guys that believed in each other. And in the end, obviously, couldn't get it done. But I really respected their resiliency and their commitment to the organization. That hey, you know what? We're Toronto Maple Leafs, and we're gonna stand here and fight. And I understood the other side. Hey, you guys, waive all your no trades so we can stock up on draft picks, and we'll just get you out the door. So yeah, you understand these things, but that's all that was there. And the thing that killed me the one year, the year, I think you'll remember it, is we won on a Saturday night against Montreal in a crazy game. I think it ended up 6-5 or 5-4 or something. And we won that night, and that gave us a chance to live another day. And the next day, we just needed New Jersey to beat the Islanders, and we were going to get in the playoffs. Like, the Leafs were going to we were going to be in the playoffs. That I'll never forget it. That Wade Dublowitz.
Wade Dublowitz. It's just known as the Wade Dublowitz game. Yes.
I'll never forget his name, because they're in the shootout, and all we needed was New Jersey to win. And like, Wade's in the net, and here come New Jersey shooters, and he poke checked three of them in a row, like three poke checks. I couldn't believe it. We missed the playoffs, and that was so disheartening, because our whole staff, as the game was going on, we were actually in there working like crazy to prepare for the first round. And the other thing I remember about that, while I'm going on, is that Saturday night game, I can't remember who the goalies were. It might have been Ray Croft. I can't remember who was in the other net. But I remember Paul Maurice. I'll never forget it. He beat Carboneau to the punch that night. And he pulled Paul Maurice.
Yeah.
Pulled his goalie first. He got him out, and it settled our team down. And then Carboneau, I thought, got too deep in with his goalie where he couldn't pull him. And we ended up winning the game by it was a high score. Somebody would have to go up and look up what it was. But it was just a wild game. And I always look back, and I told Paul this after the game. I said, "You won the game." Like, that was a night where the coach won the game for the team, because he beat the other coach to the punch on getting his goalie out there, and it really settled our group down.
Yeah, you guys were 6-3-1 to finish the season, and Buffalo was the one seed, and you would have played Buffalo, which would have been so much fun, and they beat the Islanders, who made it with Wade Dublowitz. They beat the Islanders in five games, and that's how it went. So that summer, I'm curious now, because I always say about Matts, I said, there were a lot of people really digging in on him. I remember being on the radio at the time with Bill Waters, and he loved Matts, adored him, and we defended his not only his right to do that, but then it felt like in the summer it was a little bit of a game of chicken. They weren't going to offer him a contract, and I think he felt sort of so rattled and stunted by the organization wanting to trade him that maybe he didn't. He thought a fresh start, and then he waits a few months out of the season. And then signs with Vancouver. There was very much a, my goodness, it's this, you know, superstar, and he's still 36. He still had a great year, and he's going to play for somebody, but it wasn't going to be the Leafs, Dallas, was it?
Yeah, that was interesting to all watch, and I'll be quite honest, I'm not sure what all happened there in the end.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing when you let a player like that walk and go somewhere else, especially, you know, he's your captain. There's such a there's such a premium on big centermen who can play. And but I understand with the new staff coming in with Ron and his assistants and all of that, there may be hey, you know what, we want a fresh start from everything. And that may have played into it too. And it's too bad because, like, the one thing that I really believe about players, anytime you see a guy that's hurt in training camp or you see a guy without a contract or a guy holding out, usually players who miss training camp, they don't have great seasons. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Matt obviously missed camp, signed with Vancouver late, and was just okay when he went into Vancouver. And I'll tell you what, like, I know Matt Sundin inside out, and I said it before, I played with him, and I was able to coach him. And you will be hard-pressed to find a better man, a better leader, a better person. And I don't have to talk about his play. There's not many better than him that played that position in his role.
Yeah, I mean, first ballot Hall of Famer for a big reason. Dallas Eakins is joining us. So let's talk about Edmonton. There's a lot to get into. You've said some things about it. I have more questions than the things that you've said about it. But there, I'd open by saying you're one of a list of head coaches. I follow all the list. There's 120 pro sports teams at the highest level in North America. I'm not sure a position has had more turnover until now, because Todd McClellan looks relatively safe, than Edmonton Oilers head coach. Craig McTavish gets them to Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Finals, coaches two more years. Pat Quinn is there for a year. Tom Rennie's there for two. Ralph Kruger's there for one. You get hired in the summer of 13, and as I said, you're the fifth guy in 6 years. Right away, I'd ask, did that make you... How, I mean, you got this euphoria. You're one of 30 on the planet, and you worked really hard to get to this point, and you've got some young talent to get your hands on. But did what I said at all enter into your head that this has had a lot of turnover, more than your average coaching job in any sport?
Yeah, before I get to that, like the first thing that it's amazing how you look at things over time. And that was an extremely painful situation, the way that it ended. Absolutely terrible. But I can say that I am extremely grateful for that opportunity. And I really believe it was a gift now. The adversity that I went through, my family went through, it has turned into such a gift. And we're not only is my family tighter and better for it, you know, I'm a better coach, I'm a better person, and I've grown that way. To your question is that, yeah, it went through my mind. And going back to that time, there was a lot going on with me personally. Our season had just ended with the Marley. I really believed we had that Marley program in a great spot now. Like, it was okay. It's okay to leave now. Like, you've got these guys in a great spot. Well, we're good. And we had the Edmonton offered to us. We had Vancouver on the plate as well. And I was getting ready to go in and interview with Jim Neal with the Dallas Stars and with Mr. Sather with the Rangers. And when Edmonton came knocking, they were very aggressive. And they were the ones that brought up, and believe me, I had done my homework about there's been great turnover. We want to do this. And I didn't have to negotiate a four-year deal. It was on the table right away. And looking back, maybe I should have negotiated five. But it was 4 years right out of the gate, which is usually a tough one for a first-year coach. So I really believe that there was going to be stability. There was basically a plan in place on how we all thought it was going to go. And I would be able to grow with the team and the players grow with me and try to get something special there basically by year four. And so, yeah, it did go through my head. When you see turnover like that, it makes you a little nauseous for the other guys that have gone through it. But with the way the contract was structured and the way we talked about the growth of the team, it calmed me enough to take the job.
You get to your first training camp. Now, the whole league played a short season the year before. I don't know whether I would think that impacts a younger team more, but to set it for people so they don't have to look it up, Taylor Hall's 21, Nugent Hopkins is 20, Yakupov's coming off those first 48 games of his career, Eberle and the free agent signing David Perron are almost – you know, two of your veterans. Ryan Smith is back for another run. Andrew Ferentz is your veteran defenseman. So basically, you got a lot of young talent to get your hands on. But roster wise, what were your early thoughts when you'd sit or you'd talk to Craig McTavish? What were your expectations? Because I feel like any new coach has time, and especially for a team that hasn't made the playoffs in, it would have been, I think, seven seasons on the hop when you get there.
Yeah, and the view of the roster was simple. We recruited Andrew Ferentz to try to help lead the group. He had won cups in Boston. We did our homework. Just an unbelievably incredible human being. If you have kids, this is how you want them to be raised. And if you have hockey players, this is who you want them to emulate from a leadership point of view. The young talent, absolutely. But you just went through their ages, and they had not matured. My view of it once I got into it was interesting. And this is not their fault at all. But what had been emulated there was a culture of superstar status with no team concept. So you had these young players who had already been tagged as superstars, but they'd never played a playoff game. They never made the playoffs. And so there was really no team concept there yet. And that was something that was up to me to go in and establish the culture. And so it's one of these things where, when you're at home at night and I look at all these players as my kids, basically. If there's any way to talk about how I coach, with my kids. And so I felt for them. I felt that there was a lot of pressure on these guys to be carrying these tags where they needed time to develop. So basically the general plan was, hey, we want to keep developing these guys. I had had a bit of a history, having some positive effect and influence on guys like Kadri and Gardner, guys like that. And so we wanted to keep that going, and improve as a team too, and point-wise. But once I got into it there, obviously the improving point-wise did not happen.
There was a really odd training camp story, and I want to get your read on it with the Edmonton media. And I look at it from afar, and I'm like this with all media markets. I'm like, really impressed by that guy. I never think, well, that town's media is this. I don't say that about Boston, New York, whatever. I try and judge it individually. But there was a story, I think every show, I'm sure our show mentioned it, is other media commenting. One of your first meetings with the media, there were, and there's still pictures of it that live on the internet, of carrots and salary. You like your fitness. You came in and interviewed with us once, and you ran to the radio station. You didn't take a car. You didn't take a bike. You ran a few miles to get there early in the morning. But there's all these trays of fruit and vegetables. And there's weird tweets from Ryan Rashog and other people commenting on it. What's understood and what's, I guess, misunderstood about sort of that moment? Did that put you on any kind of, I think it's humor, but I have a weird sense of humor. Was there any kind of right foot, wrong foot that got going on?
Well, that's an amazing one. It's amazing how stories grow and, hey, you tell two people, and they'll tell two people, and so on, and so on, and so on. And I still get hit with it every once in a while, and I chuckle because it's the premise out there, and the way it's been pushed along is that I came in and I changed the diet of the Edmonton media, and they went from one thing to having something else the whole time I was there. And It was actually on the day before training camp. I grabbed our team services guy and I said to him, "Hey, these guys know I'm about fitness. Just for a day, I said I'll even pay for it. Can we get them some good food out there? Like get them some healthy choices." And it just wasn't carrots and celery sticks. There was fruit and there was vegetables and there were wraps and. But it was just a far healthier choices than the donuts and the muffins and the coffee that was given to them every day. And I thought it would be two things. Number one, I thought it would be a joke and to at least strike up some humor with our guys that I was trying to get to know. And secondly, I thought it might be well received where they're like, "Hey, you know what? That was awesome. Thank you. Can we keep that going?" But obviously over the years, it's turned into a negative thing. And it wasn't my intention to take away their donuts or their muffins or anything else. It was more of a tongue-in-cheek thing and a hopeful that they might like it enough to keep it going. But it's amazing that it's, for me personally, when I get a buddy that sends me a tweet or a blurb in a story or heard it on a radio, "Hey, they're still nailing you for this." I just kind of chuckle. It's, hey, they can talk about what they want. It was literally one day, and yeah. And that was it.
And it's an odd one because winning and losing changes things. If you're at the end of the year, if you're 44-29-9 and not 29-44-9, some of that, which would be roster composition, does it even have legs? Can Mike Sullivan do that next year with Pittsburgh as a two-time defending champ? He probably can, and it's not going to get covered the same way. Do I have that? Would you say that's true?
Well, I'm sure it is. And,
yeah.
But the other thing is that, like, I've always, and this is a lesson I've learned too, and I'm not going to totally dial it back, but, me doing something like that, I should have just left it and, like, whatever, who cares? Let them eat whatever they want and don't even have a moment with them. And, or, you know what, instead, like my view of head coaches in all pro sports is, man, a lot of guys say a whole lot of nothing, but I understand why they say a whole lot of nothing now. And it's because it can't be brought back up months later or turned around on you or whatever it is. And I always wanted to go out and try to be as truthful and open as I could be. And it's, but I fully understand the premise of a guy like Belichick who comes out and gives you almost zero, and there's a reason for it, and I fully understand that now.
And yet he can't, if he's 7-9 5 years in a row, A, he's probably not even there, so the premise of my concept is invalid anyway. But he's going to get criticized for it. So he can't mumble, nonsensical answers when he hasn't won 5 Super Bowls. There's that also, right?
And the other thing is, from my side, and this is me, I went through a whole, I've turned that whole Edmonton experience upside down and in a way of how can I be better, being very critical of myself. And what the other thing is? I had not earned that right yet. I had not earned that right to even do something small like that with the food or maybe speak so freely. Guys like Daryl Sutter, guys like Belichick or whoever, they've earned the right to say whatever they want. Like you see a guy like Sutt, and I love his post-game things. Like, and I'll never forget after a loss, "Coach, what did you say to them after the game?" And he said, "Well, I said bus at 11. And that's what he said. But when you're winning, when you're a winning coach or a championship coach, you've earned the right to say whatever you want. And I had not earned that right yet. And I fully understand that. And that's a criticism of myself that I've taken note of.
So it's not a good 82 game result. The team comes into your second year, as you said, of a 4-year contract. They draft Leon Draisaitl. More on that, because that was the first top 5 pick. I think Oilers fans were like, okay, well, we'll see. And yet he might. The April and May should have told people Aaron Ekblad's pretty awesome in Florida, but Draisaitl is either the best forward in the draft universally, or he's arguably. It can't be neither. But you draft him, you won't get him right away. Did you start to feel expectations change going from year one to year two, because everybody's a year older, your vets have gotten established? Though I mentioned the goaltending, you had 6 goalies start your rookie year. That's never ideal for a head coach. It's not ideal for the goalies. What was it like stepping into 14-15 as a hockey year? Did it feel different with more heat, with more expectation than the first year?
Yes. But I'll back up. I firmly understood, and this happened quickly, was that we were barely even started that first year. And the expectation of the media, the expectation of the fans, of the whole community, was far different than the expectations that I had for that roster that we had. And that was difficult, because it was, okay, this isn't, I got the sense right away, this isn't going to go well. And the expectations were much higher for that group than what I really believed we had on paper. And so, and that's okay. That's coaching. I understood it. This great community, highly passionate community was used to a certain level of play back in the 80s and early 90s. You know, it was on, and it was something they deserved, and they were tired of losing. So that expectation obviously ramped up the second year, but you know what? Like, I thought it's amazing that the year that I get fired, like, man, I thought we had taken some real good steps moving forward. And, you know, I thought Craig Ramsey came in and had a real positive effect on the group. I thought Rocky Thompson came in and gave us another really positive voice. And going into that training camp and that whole part of training camp, and even starting the season, like, man, I felt good about the group, because, there's a lot of talk about analytics. And if you want to talk about analytics, it's the thing that I value most is chances. And that's not analytics. Roger Nielsen, I've been tracking chances for Roger Nielsen since I was friggin' 12 years old. And so I know their value in the game. And we went from being a team that the first year being outchanced constantly, almost 2-1, you know, some nights it's 20-10 for the other team. And then where are the high quality chances coming from? Well, the other team's got all the high quality ones. We get into the second year, man, it was tight. It was, hey, the chances are 14-14, or maybe they have chances 15-13. Like, that margin had shrunk. And now we were in the games. We weren't just getting crushed every night chance-wise. And that's where I put the real value in. And I stick to that. I know I got fired. I know we lost 15 of our last 16 games, whatever it was there. Mm-hmm. But we had taken the step forward. Now, the unfortunate thing is that step forward, we needed that in year one. That's mm-hmm. where we needed that step. And I could have personally survived the bad record the first year, and we would have had the improvement. I think we could have built on it, but it didn't come until the second year. We couldn't get on the right side of a bunch of one-goal games, and it was adios to me.
Well, you got Dallas Aikens, our guest, by the way. You got 31 games. You start 0-4-1. You had to play the Canucks twice. Willie Desjardins is the new coach there. They came out very strong. They had a home advantage in the playoffs. People forget. I know Vancouver doesn't look good now, but just 2 years ago they had a new coach and were rolling. You lose to the Kings. Then you win 4 straight. Then you lose 4 straight. Then you win 2 more, so you've won 6-10. and you mentioned it, you lose four straight one-goal games. You lose a close game in New Jersey. Chicago blows you out. Couple more one-goal games, couple overtime games. You're remembering this. All of a sudden, you're on an 11-game losing skid and through 26 games, and you're 6-15-5. How tight did it obviously feel for you morning, noon, and night with your family at the rink, driving here, driving there? What were you feeling?
It was, I can't even describe it. And it's because of my, and believe me, I know all coaches are competitive. I know players. I know fans are competitive. But I know my personal level of competitiveness. It's driven me from, you know, being a 10th round draft pick to being able to play over 1,000 games pro, being shipped around from team to team. I'm a competitive person. And I was, man, through that last streak of those last, whatever it was, 16 games, 15 games, whatever it was, like there was little sleep. There was, it was just unhealthy. It was unhealthy mentally. It was terrible on my wife. And so, yeah, it's hard. But as soon as I say that, I'm like, number one, that's part of the deal. And I'm always one to be the first one to say, if you don't like your job or if you don't like your life, then change it. So I knew this was part of the deal. I had watched Roger Neilson, basically my second father, go through these situations many times. And so I knew what was up. And I'm a big boy. But that doesn't discount. It was hard. And it was really hard through those last bunch to – you know, whatever it was, I think we lost 11 games. If you take out empty net goals, yeah. I think we lost 11 games by one goal, like out of the last 15. And I understand that. Yeah, you got to get on the other side of that. But I still go back to our group was not ready, maturity wise, experience wise, roster wise. We just weren't there yet. The one thing that is great to see now is that to see where that team is now, and there's been a ton of changes, but I'm just so happy for the fans and the community that they're building a real contender there, and they're a very, very fun team to watch.
And it's tough to I'm not going to, you know, blow the brains out on the goaltending that year when you were there and when you were replaced. But you guys were 30th in 5-on-5 save percentage at .901. No other team in the NHL was worse than .909. That factored in. Some of that isn't all goalkeeping, but that's the best metric I can think to judge whether a goalie is making a save as opposed to goals against. What were you got right back on the horse, moved to San Diego, where we started our conversation. Were you ready the next season? Had had that been at the end of the year as opposed to before even Christmas? Would there have been trepidation? Were you absolutely fried and didn't want to watch the sport even? People are like that in our business. They're like, I got fired from radio. I can't listen to the radio for a couple months. It just doesn't work that way.
Well, going back to the goaltend, I don't want to hammer on those goalies.
Okay.
Like, every one of those guys, they gave us everything they had in that moment. And, you know, it's been great to see Dubes recover his career after a couple of tough starts or tough situations after he left us. And so, you know, that's exciting to see. But, you know, that was a tough position for a team that was not ready roster-wise, obviously, have not grown enough. When you're giving up that many chances in that year one, it's going to hurt. And, you know, it's interesting, too, talking about that, like the systems that we put in place. It didn't matter what system we ran. We changed one of our systems early in the season, and one that people were highly critical of. And the chances actually got worse after we had changed it. And so we just kept slugging it out. And that first season and the second season, it's in the end, it's all on me. And I don't want the fingers pointed at those goalies. They did the best mm-hmm. they could for us. Now, coming in here to San Diego, what we did after Edmonton is we were going to stay. Our plan was just to stay in Edmonton. The girls were in the good schools, and then we just decided that it was maybe better to get out of there. And at Christmas time, we moved over to we took our daughters out of school, and we moved to Vancouver, where we have a great connection of friends. And we lived in Vancouver right through until the summer, and you know, I kind of refound myself and on the grouse grind. And if there's anyone listening, if you ever go to Vancouver, go over, find the grouse grind. It's a great climb up there, and I hammered that thing you know, almost daily, and I was able to clear my head and you know, really do a big self-assessment and see what's coming next. And, you know, we had a few different opportunities that summer to do some different things. But in the end, we thought with Bob Murray, his success with the Ducks, I'd known Bob for quite a number of years, that it would be fun to come in and start a program up fresh. And I really looked at it as the first years when I took over the Marlies. We're really going to try to build a really great program that can sustain itself over a long, long haul. And I can't tell you what a blessing it's been to be here.
Yeah.
You know, we're healthy, we're happy, we're way better as a family, as people. We're grateful for our time in Edmonton in the turmoil. We still have unbelievable connections back in Toronto, where we still basically call home. We still have our home there. So it's just been a great experience being here in San Diego, and a place that, you know, I still want to be. I like coaching here, and we don't have the program to where I want it yet. We've had a couple of great regular seasons where we're kind of in that 640, 650 range, winning percentage somewhere in there. The program's not where I want it yet. And I want to get this thing built out perfectly.
It's amazing you say that because, yeah, the tone in your voice when you start talking about San Diego in the future, not that it's so different than you talking about the past in Edmonton or the good times in Toronto, but you always seem to be not a rear-view mirror guy. You're looking through the windshield. I'd ask you about NHL coaching and the sort of climate that I can't tell if it's just the give it to me now society. I can't tell if it's the proliferation of media, but when I tell you that only 13 coaches that will start the year, because Buffalo hasn't even hired one, 13 coaches had the job when they finished the 2015 season, and 17 are new or sort of new, you wouldn't be surprised by that. It is so that's closer almost to 67% than it is 50%. And that's the turnover. Guys are getting 2 years, 3 years, less than that in your case. Does it ever change back? Can we ever have more patience with the job when 16 out of 30 teams make the playoffs and that's what people are judged by?
Well, I hope so. And not for my benefit, in a general terms of organization and you know, what do you see? The best way to put it is, like, what do you see when a coach gets fired? Usually what's being said, written, maybe it's even out of the owner's mouth, or we need a culture change. And the one thing I know for sure is coming through Toronto, and then with all of my experiences, and even right now with the team that I have, culture takes years to build. You don't come in and make a coaching change and suddenly the culture changed overnight. It takes years to build it, to get it to where you want it. And now, are there times where you change a coach and suddenly they start winning? Yeah, absolutely. But if you want to talk culture, the absolute way that an organization, a team interacts with each other, what are their values, it takes years to do that. And so that's where I'm like, man, if you're going to change out a coach or even a manager, I don't care what business you're in. It's going to take time to change that culture. And I think some people need that time. And as soon as I say it, I know the other side of it. We are in a results-oriented business. People want wins, and they don't care what the roster looks like or where the team is at. They want to win now. And that's part of the part of the deal in coaching. And it's interesting you say that about the coaches. Like, that's the one thing that really inspires me. It is the adversity of being fired. And when you look at coaches that have that are out there now, like, who inspires me? You know what? That's Sullivan. Sully inspires me. Second time around, he's doing great. Boucher inspires me personally. Second time around, doing well. Gullickson, guys like Pete Carroll in Seattle. You know, suffered early, comes back, and if you look at it, even all the general managers in the NHL, these guys are smart guys, man. And if you go through it, more than half of them have all been fired before, and they're on to another job. And so down the road, when I'm ready and my family's ready, I hope someone is ready to go, hey, you know what? I think that guy can coach. I know there's a stink on him from that Edmonton experience, and rightly so. I accept that, and rightly so. But I wonder if he's better for it. I wonder if he's learned some good lessons. And I wonder if he's a way better coach now. And I hope that opportunity comes. And if it doesn't, I'm more than happy to be here developing these young men. It's something that I take great pride in, and I love the relationships that are built over time, and how guys that not only that you're coaching today are going to be stay in touch down the road, but the guys that you've coached in the past are still reaching out to you from time to time, and that's the fun part of it for me. I go back to it's like your kids. All these guys, man, you really love them, and it's fun coaching them.
So as we wrap, would your career feel complete without a second NHL job? I mean, we make the most of what we get, right? We get married, we have kids, we have a job. We I think about retirement. I'm excited to retire someday, but God, I look forward every day to going into work. That's way in the distance. But I hope to enjoy that as much as I do working. If I said there is an NHL job and a second crack at it, or a third, as in some cases, as you said, some guys have, does it feel incomplete without it?
Well, I think it's time to coach myself, and I tell the players all the time, like, you know, you have an outcome in mind for what you want in your career, and so you can close your eyes and you wake up in the morning, you go to bed at night, like you have an outcome. So maybe that's your first NHL game. Maybe it's making a whole bunch of money, or whatever it is. And so me, from the professional side, is my vision and what I would like to try to achieve one day is what just happened to the Pittsburgh Penguins. You see that coach with that cup. I chased that cup as a player. I was never quite good enough to be a real steady guy on an NHL team. But I so badly wanted to be part of a group to win a Stanley Cup, and I couldn't do it as a player. And now that's the goal as a coach. That's my outcome that I want for my career. Now, how do I get there? Well, you know what I got to do? I got to stay in the moment. And it goes back to what my mother told me years ago. I was trying to save money for something I wanted. And she said, Dallas, you look after the pennies, the dollars look after themselves. And I encourage my players to do that. We have to stay in the moment. How can I get better in this moment? Like, how can I do it? How can I stay in the moment, get better in this moment? And all these moments and all these marginal gains, they turn into something much, much bigger. They're the pennies turning into dollars. And so, yeah, is there going to be a time when I want to get back to the NHL? Absolutely. Absolutely. And will I look back on it if I don't get another chance, disappointed? Yes, absolutely. But I'm looking forward. I'm staying in the moment. I'm trying to get better. And I hope by keeping my head down, working hard, getting better every day, getting those marginal gains, that's going to turn into your career just looks after itself. And I really believe in that. It's how I coach, and it's how I live.
Well, it's two very successful years in the AHL. San Diego, it's a great place to live. More people should live there. great, healthy family. I had a whole, we're so out of time. I had a whole bunch of fitness questions. I was going to, like, about eating after 9 o'clock. I'll have to save them for next time we go. Cause I don't think there's a better AHL coach to advise our listeners on that sort of, now, like you're saying, stay away from the croissants after 10 o'clock or before 6 a.m. probably for that matter. So.
Yeah, you probably just want to stay away from croissants.
Period. Yeah, there's nothing in them. They're empty. They're empty calories. I can't thank you enough for doing this. Have a great summer. You're in San Diego. You will, and maybe we'll pick this back up again in the fall. And I know busy off season. Anaheim getting ready for the draft. Getting ready for free agency. You're in on that as well. Can't thank you for doing this. A lot of fans in Toronto, and they'll be eager to hear your comments on this podcast.
Well, I'll tell you what. We're back in Toronto there for a few weeks in July, and I'll look you up, and I look forward to seeing the people on the streets of Toronto in mid-July there. It's always fun.
Dallas, thanks so much for this. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
So NBA season complete. We're going to talk to Carolyn Cammer. We're going to call her in Vancouver, but I managed to wrangle in between tapings, in between producing, in between actually hosting shows. One of the busier people at Sportsnet and Sportsnet 590. The Fan is J.D. Bunkus. He was filling in also for the Jeff Blair show. So, boy, what a great lead-in show he had for 2 days with Dan Riccio.
It was a lot. It was a lot. A lot of people were talking about it.
Oh, yeah. J.D. Bunkus joins us. Now, have you taped Free Association for this week already, or is that upcoming?
So it's coming up. We're trying to figure out a time. My boy Donovan Bennett is in Sweden during
what?
The NBA final. Yeah, I don't know. Some bachelor friendship trip. A lot of pictures of him on bicycles and... Yeah, enjoying...
With his wife?
No, with his friends. He's got like a good guy friend group where they do little travels together. Is it the Hinterland? Is that Sweden?
No, I don't feel like that's...
That's wrong?
And I don't even know if that sounds like an Austrian accent.
Well, that's where I was like, that's where he is.
Those games, I've been in England before for NBA Finals, so the games start at like 2:19 in the morning.
Yeah.
As if he's getting up to see them or staying up to
see
them.
Well, it must be nice for Donovan to be in a country where he actually knows more about basketball than the vast majority of the population.
Yeah, about 30-40% of the Swedish people. Plus, he, you know, if he didn't see the games, then he didn't see Steph Curry be like whatever he was, 4-for-18 from three-point land the last two games of the
Donovan's
of the playoffs.
Steph Curry is the MVP. Opinion.
I had him as the most important Golden State Warrior coming into the playoffs. Yeah,
that hurt. That took a little bit of a hit.
Yeah, it takes a little bit of a
So how's this
ding.
Going? You just made me, you're like, you set me up by saying I'm one of the busiest people here.
Yeah.
And yet I
and
just
you had time.
Spent,
you had time
I just
to
spent
wait.
Half an hour in, let's call it the waiting room. Which is
you ever been
to
the dentist?
Studio.
The dentist doesn't see you right away.
Yeah,
this is like oral surgery
but
here
a dentist
with me.
Dentist is like an important person, and he's performing oral surgery on people. People's teeth are in his hands.
I'm getting so much more from people, ex head coaches, current NHL, you know, future Hall of Famers.
Okay,
Matt Bonner. I'm
Did
getting
Matt
way
Bonner?
More. Yeah, last week
it was great.
Way more from these people than now. By the way, Matt Bonner. I don't know if enough people knew this because I saw him one night. And I think I texted you. He came into Toronto and just sat in with Devlin, and I think it was a Sportsnet game, so I want to say he was with Leo. I'd say if it was Jack and TSN, but he was so good, and then I'm like, damn, he's really good.
Yeah, he's
but
great.
I didn't already know he was doing San Antonio games, and Sean Elliott does them too, so he must not do all of them.
No, he does some home broadcasts, and this only started this year, right? He's kind of the fill-in guy, and he does the, you know how they cut to the studio show that's kind of in arena?
Yes.
He'll do those, right? So, yeah, no, he's great. And it's too bad because the Raptors, honestly, he would have been an excellent fill-in guy here. But I think he's made his home in San Antonio.
Yeah, it sounds like it'd be very casual.
He's a Massachusetts guy. So you'd think that Toronto would have had a shot at least of having him be close. But he's so popular here.
He said he doesn't want to do the Doris Burke, late Craig Sager first interview Greg Popovich after the first quarter. Even though he's a former coach and they have a relationship, he still doesn't want to do that. Yeah. He doesn't think he's going to get anything out of him.
Not only that. I think that would be
demeaning.
Yeah, I think for a player, like we would think this is the, like everybody teased Brian Scalabrine, remember? It was like, oh, white Mamba, white Mamba, white Mamba. He's not a player, he's not a player. And actually, Bonner's a bit of a comp because he's an unathletic, ginger, pasty white guy that people kind of assume is, yeah, he's a three-point shooter and he's in the NBA because he can shoot and not because he's a great basketball player. And it's actually very to the contrary. And Scalabrine took the heat for a really long time and then eventually he kind of had... Not a snapping moment, but he held that contest. I don't know if you caught that with the radio station in Boston. where he basically invited a bunch of former like good high school basketball players.
No.
And like Div 2 college player to give him a run one-on-one, and he just absolutely barbecued all of them. Like,
all of them?
Oh, yeah. It was like not
there
even
must be
close.
Guys faster than him that can shoot more from the outside.
No, that was
perimeter shooters.
He murdered them. It was a desecration. Is that
that's
not
some
good
word.
So basically I think Bonner would be the same way when it comes to media, right? Like, you can't be a sideline reporter.
I suppose
a guy that
see
steps
you're younger than me, but the Ahmad Rashad, like, I never had a radio show for a good chunk of time when Ahmad Rashad was doing the NBA sidelines, and that always just seemed the weirdest fit for me. I know people can enjoy more than one sport, and Boomer Esiason can be a good talk show host, and though he's an NFL player, we don't have a hockey example. I don't think we've ever had a hockey example become a excellent generic sports host. I know there's guys working on it getting better, but Ahmad Rashad doing NBA stuff was always weird to me, because I'm like,
really?
Of course,
because
he played basketball, he would have watched basketball, but then he became like an expert. He's hosted and the Saturday morning show that Grant Hill does now. He did that. He did a lot of NBA.
But that's what I mean.
So I'm being too critical.
I only knew him as NBA inside stuff as a kid. Like, I only
That's
knew
right.
him as basketball.
Not an NFL guy.
Yeah, I wouldn't be able to look at him as anything else.
So the finals wrap, we'll get to the Raptors' perspective on this, offseason on this. The finals wrap, they get great ratings. The regular season ratings were down. Before we get to the finals itself, what does this do to next year's? Everyone thinks the regular season's a slog, at least in terms of the players. We know what the travel's like. We know what the schedule's like. The first 40-50 games are hard to forecast getting as excited as you are to sit in front of a television and watch, but we'll all come around again. What did the finals do to sort of dampen the regular season, given that we had three playoff rounds where maybe 5-6 games out of 14 series before the final, I should say, stood out where you're like, wow, that was great.
But do you mean like dampen the regular season we just saw, or the one that we're
the
going
one that's
to see
coming
next year?
Up? The okay. impact of it for people to say, well, Cleveland didn't care about it at different times, and at times Golden State and San Antonio didn't. So why should I? Why will I pay $150 to go? Why will I give it 4 hours of television a night, even if I love the sport? Why will I be into these games as much as I was?
Well, I think that if you're a fan of the NBA, and you have been for a while anywhere, even if you're a new fan, that a lot of the reason why you watch is because you like to watch super freaks play a sport, right? You watch sports for different reasons, whether like it's the NFL for the contact, whether it's Major League Baseball for the intense one-on-one battles, whether you watch hockey for just the parity and the grueling of the regular season. And again, physical play. I think the NBA, the most attractive thing in it is that it has star power and that it's, in my opinion anyways, the greatest athletes on the planet flying around. So I think that the product itself doesn't really suffer. On a greater scale, next year is going to be interesting because I don't know if I'm kind of caught at this pivot point where I feel like it can go either one of two ways, right? Where it's like, okay, one way you could see the NBA basically just being the Warriors that dominate everybody for 3 years, and then something happens to the Warriors, they end up breaking up. Somebody leaves, they're never the same, and then the NBA kind of goes back to the status quo, which is just waiting for the next team to arise, or the next player, whether it's Antetokounmpo, or whether it's the Celtics with amassing all these picks, who knows. Or, and this is the way I'm kind of trying to spin it optimistically, is that this is the new NBA, and you're going to see more and more super teams, you're going to see more guys leave their situations. The cap, it was designed to keep guys in the same place, basically, right? Like, you look at Chris Paul, he basically designed the rule to give him $200 million to re-sign with the Clippers. And now he really has to outweigh that with, you know what, maybe it's not worth the $200 million. I can catch $150 million, a sacrifice to $50. Maybe I add a few more endorsement deals and I go somewhere where I can win and I'm in the public eye a little bit more and my legacy is saved a little bit. Maybe that $50 million isn't worth as much as it once was to me. I think that we're going to see more super teams. And I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing, because when I watched that finals, that was the best basketball I've ever seen. Like, have you ever seen anything better than that?
Well, I honestly thought the series 2 years ago was great, and then Kyrie's injury became final.
I thought we were
on our way to
Love.
An all-timer. And but that said, when you look at the series last year, only Game 7 was really close. There were really six blowouts, six very decisive wins.
But I just mean in terms of the quality of play this year.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen anything better than this? No.
Well, no, and we haven't seen two dominant teams. Like, a lot of people have referenced the Lakers in 01 when Iverson's the MVP and Philly actually shocked them the first game at Staples and
they
won.
They lost 26 games in the regular season.
But they weren't a great regular season team. San Antonio was better in terms of seeding. So, no. And I'm at the same point where I am with the three-pointer. It's become such a... I don't know what to say about... I think I've talked to you before about it. Seeing 64 threes a game... It's not the basketball I grew up with. I almost enjoyed the NCAA tournament more because guess what? Kids aren't as good at shooting the three. Even though the line is closer, they aren't as precise. And errors sometimes, I mean, sometimes the best NFL games are sloppily played and there's mud and there's wind. And I don't know how I feel about the preciseness and the art that Golden State has at this and at the three-pointer. I don't know how everyone else can get as good at it as they are. They simply cannot.
Well, I do think that...
But they're trying. That's the problem.
Yeah, I do think that we're going to see more and more shooters coming up. Guys that... Like, I talked to Alvin Williams the other day, and he...
Name dropping.
Yeah, well, no, he just came on the show.
Yeah, sure.
And he was just saying, we were talking about how the Warriors could affect AAU ball. And I think that that's also a really interesting thing, is that, you know, the Spurs for a while have been doing what the Warriors have been doing the last couple of years, which is, hey, we're going to share the ball, we're going to have unselfish players, unselfish style of play, and we're going to shoot a lot of threes, we're going to space the floor, we're going to play defense. But the Spurs weren't sexy. Like, no one cared about Tim Duncan. No kid was in a gym working on his low post game saying, I want to be the next Tim Duncan. No one was even saying, I want to be the next Manu Ginobili or Tony Parker. But the Warriors are sexy. The Warriors are a team that's going to be in the public eye. Kevin Durant is going to sell shoes. Steph Curry is going to sell shoes. People are going to even want to be like Klay Thompson, a guy that plays two ways and fills it up and gets a lot of three-point shots. Draymond Green is always going to be in the news,
yeah,
making noise. He's going to be a guy that people try to build their games around. And what are these teams? It's a team ball. It's a team game.
Here's what I worry about. Is there a Tim Duncan who's 17, who's 6'9 and a half, who's going to become 6'11, who's 16, 17 years old, and he's in a high school, and he's going to get recruited hard? I mean, Wake Forest was not – they're a good school, but they weren't – Tim Duncan wasn't incredibly recruited. This wasn't Shaq going to LSU or all the guys that go, Shane Battier going to Duke. But is there a Tim Duncan sitting there at age 16, JD, who is just saying, oh my God, the sport's changing and everyone told me I'd make millions of dollars at this and now I'm really worried because I can't shoot?
Well, no, but that's the thing. They have to learn how to shoot. That's what they're doing. But there's some guys that aren't going to be able to do it, and I think there's going to be a market correction at some point. Right?
So I heard Jonas Valanciunas Dwayne Casey on Blair's show, and he's like, we're going to shoot more threes.
Yep.
We're working on everybody. We're working on Valanciunas shooting the three. He isn't going to. He won't be able to, and that it impacts everything else he can do or can't do on the floor. So already, like, you'd concur – Valanciunas and Tristan Thompson go 4 or 5 in the same draft. And to me, already 5 years later, 6 years later, their effectiveness in the NBA is stunted because of how the sport's changed. It's incredible.
But I would say this, that Tristan Thompson, the difference between him and Valanciunas is that no big goes out to the perimeter and guards point guards at the center position quite like Tristan Thompson. Nobody offensive rebounds. No one brings kind of that level of motor that kind of elevates his team. JV is a bit of an off and on player. If he doesn't get his touches, he can sulk. His body language is, I think, a little bit toxic at times. And he excels at the least efficient shot in basketball, which we now know, which is get the ball in the low block and try to go at somebody with a sky hook over a defender or a little baby hook over a defender. It's like, that's not a good shot.
So that's what I mean. He's limited.
Yeah,
I don't know how you make him a 27 into what Bargnani was trying to be here, let's say.
No, but
say,
what I'm saying is,
or
like,
Nowitzki.
But is it a bad thing that we know? Like, there's never going to be a place in time where there's not going to be a low post game. Like, look at how the Cavaliers tried to get their last bucket. It was, or try to get back into it. It was give LeBron James the ball on the low block, let him try to work on Klay Thompson. Klay Thompson is just incredible and got to stop. But I don't think that part of the game is going to be completely eliminated. But yeah, bigs are going to have to stretch out more. And you're seeing that in the draft this year. Like, mm-hmm. Lauri Markkanen, the kid out of Arizona, they're saying, okay, he might not be good defensively, but he can already shoot the three. Jonathan Isaac, we're going to need you from Florida State to step out and shoot a little bit. If you can't play defense, then you have to have something in the modern NBA. And yeah, unfortunately, like the big plotter that gets the ball in the low block that can't play defense the other way, the Al Jeffersons, yeah, they're done. But Tim Duncan, he would still fit in because he plays excellent defense. Like, he's always been able to find a spot in the league because, yeah, you know what? He could shoot out from 15 feet and he could play defense. And so there's always going to be a demand for that. But do you not think that even that Tim Duncan kid, that he's going to be able to learn how to shoot? Like, it's really, it's about repetition.
I hope so, but in high school, it's so easy, he doesn't have to. Like, Christian Laettner, you watch,
right, that's
true. If you watch the 30 for 30, the IA Christian Laettner, he just could eat up guys inside so much, he didn't need to shoot. And then eventually he got to Duke, and he had to shoot.
Right,
and,
but
and,
it's, but the best people that rise up in anything, it's not about what you need to do, it's about the extra stuff that you have to
accomplish.
Right,
it comes, think of the NFL quarterbacks, it comes so easy. Everything up until the pros, and maybe even the first couple years of the pros came easy for Michael Vick. You're so freaking athletic. High school comes so easy, VaTech comes so easy. Guess what, you gotta get in, you gotta work as hard as Peyton Manning. You gotta watch as much film, you gotta work as hard as, you can't have a beer or a coffee during the season like Tom Brady. You gotta do everything imaginable. And some quarterbacks do it. Russell Wilson has done it. He's excelled at, he's overachieved at every level for high school, for at North Carolina, Wisconsin, at Seattle. Every level, he's far exceeded what people thought he would do. Let me ask you about LeBron and the comment. This is a bigger picture. J.D. Bunkus with us, by the way, of course, co-host of Free Association with Donovan Bennett, also right here on sportsnet.ca/590. Sometimes not as long a podcast lengthwise as Point Taken. Just happens that way sometimes.
I think you're supposed to aim for your pods around an hour, they say.
40 minutes? Okay.
Yeah, but how much of those are your questions? How much of it we chunked it out?
It's too high a percentage. I don't want to give a raw number.
Hey, sorry, not to try to take control of your podcast.
You can.
But I'm just curious as to, like, we were talking about the way the NBA is going, and you don't like the three-point shooting.
Yeah.
Not maybe you don't like the three-point shooting.
It's too many.
But maybe it's a lot. I do agree that when you're watching the Warriors and it does feel like you can't stop them, and Kevin Durant's hitting contested threes late in the shot clock, and you're saying, okay, well, what's even the point of defense? Why not just have a three-point contest? I can understand that argument a little bit. But do you not believe that there's a good chance that, like, the stigma's gone for super teams now? We had LeBron James. Kevin Durant took – no one's going to get criticized like LeBron and KD, right? KD did the worst thing imaginable. He joined one of the best teams in NBA history,
73-19, right,
as a former MVP – and won a championship, and now we already have those commercials like Nike where it's like, hey, bait this. Or
that
whatever.
Didn't take very long.
Nah, that was pretty stupid. And then LeBron, after the celebration and the not one, not two, even denying that there was a super team, he had the celebrations and everyone killed him. We were like celebrating in the streets when he lost to Dallas. But now it's like Chris Paul is a free agent.
I know.
And we're saying, hey, I hope he goes to San Antonio. We don't care that we don't want him to stay.
Paul George should accept a trade.
Right.
If he's going to leave anyway from Indiana, accept a trade for Kevin Love. We've already made this trade up.
Exactly.
Whether we know that Indiana
and
Cleveland want
it. We want better teams now. And so do you think that that's necessarily a bad thing that there's going – like there's already bad teams in the NBA every single year. There's always teams tanking. And you're going to have a couple of exciting younger teams that are building those prospects and building up through the draft, which are like the Milwaukee's with the Antetokounmpo, like the Minnesota Timberwolves, like the 76ers. So those guys are always going to be there. You're always going to have the crappy Magic teams anyway. So why not take the best players off the Magic? Why not say the Magic, hey, you know what? They're going to trade Aaron Gordon, and he's going to go somewhere where they can actually have a chance to win. Aaron Gordon's going to Chicago, and he's going to join Jimmy Butler, and we're going to try to make more super teams, and these guys are going to try to play with each other and elevate the basketball to where the Warriors are.
But I had a question about Shaq, and I will get to it. What do you do with the markets? You got 14 teams that miss the playoffs, and then a bunch of teams enter the playoffs and know they can't win. And you know where you don't have that? Hockey. And I know it splinters because the first round happens. It's awesome. It's fantastic. Then all of a sudden there's eight teams. There's 22 teams gone and there's only eight left. And it fractures. We're like, I like that series. I don't want to watch much of that series. Minnesota St. Louis doesn't do it for me. And then you get to the final and I think we all kind of reconvene. The NBA is almost the opposite. I feel like it's a slow build up to where, oh my God, okay, Washington-Boston game seven, I'll give it a go. That Clippers San Antonio game seven 2 years ago was fantastic.
Yeah,
on
it was
Saturday.
Awesome.
It was the Saturday night of the Mayweather Pacquiao fight.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. But we only have so many moments like that. Even Toronto Milwaukee, it was fun to have a moment. And actually, now that we think about it, have it not be a blowout. It was fun to get adrenalized by you get killed in game three at Bradley Center and then you win game four. But we only had so many of those moments.
Here's the thing, though. I like hockey. Like the NHL.
It's random.
Not only is it random. It's like, I like parody. Like, I think the NFL has actually the best mix where you still have dynasties and you still have new teams coming in every year that give it fresh blood that can win their division
and
make the playoff
run. You do.
And it also doesn't allow for complete randomness because there's not a lot of teams in it, right? So,
but also player movement's really boring.
Sure.
Like, I can't think of an NFL offseason move where I'm like, wow, that happened.
Player
I can't believe it.
Player
Even Jeremy Maclin is like, and look, it's June. Training camp's next month, and we get Jeremy Maclin moving. But outside of that, the most amazing thing that happened in the offseason, people, I think, said and debated, was how the hell did Houston get Cleveland to take Osweiler?
Sure.
And that's not a good thing for the league to talk about how the team, the 35th best quarterback in the league, got taken by the worst team in a trade.
Of you, 35th.
I used to like him a lot more.
Yeah.
Okay,
40. Yeah, you.
I still think they win the Super Bowl with him. That's my good
Thanks
opinion.
For that. No, but all I'm saying about the NFL is that they do a good mix of parity where it does feel like every team can win, but there are still dynasties like the Patriots that you really want to try and topple and that get revered. And the NHL, even though the Penguins have won back-to-back, it just doesn't really have that. And what I was going to say about the league is they have a flat cap this year. Like, the players aren't escalating the cap because there's just no extra revenue. They weren't able to generate any extra revenue from the last year. I don't think that it really translates very well. Like, I don't think the parity matters. I think star power matters. And that's why it's so funny that they put the gag order on PK Subban. It's like, here's the one interesting guy that people want to hear from. And instead, before, you know, game six of the Stanley Cup final, you're hearing from Patrick Hornqvist and a bunch of other nobodies, Brian Dumoulin. Like, who cares? Like, we want to hear from the stars. And the NHL doesn't do a very good job of marketing their stars. And as long as they keep that hockey culture around, it's going to be that way. The NBA, the one thing it'll always have is that every market seems to at least have a star. Even if you don't have the ability to win, you have your guy. You go to the arena every night and you say, okay, like, here's our guy. We get that exciting moment. DeMar DeRozan, for all his flaws, Kyle Lowry, for all his flaws, we get those moments
They're
where you go to the ACC where it goes, hey, it's Lowry time and the ACC is popping off. And you get individual spectacular plays that go viral through Twitter, that go into Vines and go into little clips, and they lead SportsCenter and they look at these and say, wow, these are unbelievable athletic accomplishments that we can really relate to. Sometimes it's hard to relate to a hockey play. Like, it's really hard to understand how difficult some of these things that the players do are. With basketball, it's guys in shorts and T-shirts jumping around and shooting and doing something that pretty much all of us have done, which is shoot a basketball. So I just don't really think the league's in a real difficult place because of the lack of parity, because the league has never been a league about parity. Like, go through the history of the game. There's generally a team that dominates. There's a team that owns the era. That's what we do. Which team owned that era? Was it in the 2000s? Was it the Spurs or the Lakers? Well, guess what? There was only two. The Bulls owned the 90s. The Lakers and the Celtics owned the 80s.
Yeah. When I was a kid, I started watching, there were three really good teams, and it was Boston, Philadelphia, and L.A. That's where that Dr. J versus Larry Bird video game for the Commodore 64 came from.
But I'm saying it hasn't suffered up until this point, so why is it going to get worse even if the Warriors have a super team? That ratings are up.
I know,
they're
but
higher than they've ever been.
If we'd had a San Antonio Washington final, you'd watch, I'd watch, we got to watch, we like to
and
watch.
Nobody else would watch.
But a lot of people would have bitched about it. A lot of people would have complained about that series. Like, here's John Wall, there's his breakthrough. And you have to have two amazing things happen. San Antonio has to beat this amazing Golden State team with Durant. And Washington has to, well, they got to beat Boston. I picked them. They got to beat Boston in that Game 7 on the road. And then they got to beat the Cavs with everybody healthy. And that should be enough that we'd be so amazed by that. We'd be like, wow, great. Now the story continues. And we would have been like, boring. I'm bored.
That's what I mean.
We wouldn't have liked that.
The cool thing in basketball is that, and again, this is, I'm kind of sounding like a bit of a basketball apologist here because I do have problems with what's happened this year. I did not like the Kevin Durant move. I don't really appreciate that a team like the Raptors that has been building a good team for years and years and years feels like they're not as good. Or they're not as in a good place as, you know, say the 76ers or another team that's tanking. Like, honestly, would you rather be the Raptors or the Orlando Magic? It's a debate, and that's insane. So, yeah, that sucks. I'm not trying to apologize for the league, but the great thing about it, I do think, is that, yeah, there isn't a lot of variance. The best players get there. We get to see the best players on the biggest stage in the NBA. We get to see the best teams go head-to-head in the final most years. It's very rare where it's not the two best teams in the NBA final facing off against each other.
I said on the morning show, the only thing I'd compare Durant to is if, like, Karl Malone in 1996, and he's probably too old, went to, it probably would have to be Sean Kemp even in 96 going to the Bulls.
I was
going to
say, or Barkley in 93.
Or Barkley. But we forget, Rodman goes to the Bulls when he's valuable. Rodman and Kukoc get added to the Bulls when Jordan comes back. Rodman's 34.
And he'd won
twice. And Pippen and Barkley go to Houston, but they're in their mid-30s. Does Shaq's the only one I can think of. He goes when he's 26. Yeah. He goes when he's 26 to the Lakers to join a young Kobe Bryant. Does he get Is it the LeBron and Durant and even Ray Allen prior to go to Boston? Are they all too criticized, or did Shaq get too much of a pass for going and saying, I've had it in Orlando. I've been to the finals. I can't do it here. No one ever says that about him and gives him the same stick. No one ever did. No one ever will. Gives him the same stick they gave LeBron.
Reasons for that, right?
Well, tell me the biggest one.
Well, biggest one for me is that the Magic screwed it up. They tried to nickel and dime Shaq. They were afraid to give him all the money he wanted, and then they gave an opportunity for him to slip between their fingers. They knew that he was attracted to Los Angeles. They knew that he wanted to be a star, that he was bigger than the game. Man, Shaq is the first superstar in my lifetime where I remember just like, other than like MJ, where it was like shampoo bottles and shoes and shirts and his brand.
First couple years,
unbelievably massive. Shaq was everywhere. He was a super duper star. It was incredible, his popularity. Man, and to the point where he was leaning off on Penny Hardaway to have original Chris Rock doing the Lil Penny ads, which were also huge. Shaq was massive, and Orlando didn't handle the situation properly. They gave an opportunity for him to leave, and then once L.A. came in and said, hey, man, you want to be a superstar? You want to come to L.A.? Like, let's do it. It wasn't even a super team. They had Kobe Bryant, who was a blossoming young player, and he was incredible. But when he joined those guys, it was like the Lakers weren't exactly like a super powerhouse. He joined them, I think, they had Glenn Rice, Kobe Bryant. Mm. Kobe Bryant wasn't even starting when Shaq went there. He was the sixth man.
You didn't know he was going to become Kobe, but you knew he
would be a good player.
It's not Iverson who's the number one overall pick.
He wasn't like bandwagoning with the other best player in the league. Kobe Bryant was the sixth man when he first went there. Glenn Rice was the starting two. I'm almost positive of that.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, it's hard for me to really say it's the same when Shaq gets a pass. When his market screwed it up, he gave them an opportunity. The market, like the past ownership group in that little mini documentary I think ESPN did on them, has admitted fault to letting Shaq go. Shaq wishes he stayed with Penny. In fact, he was better off staying with Penny at the time than Kobe. If you would have asked, I bet you if you would have pulled 30 GMs in the NBA at that time, who's the better player, Penny Hardaway or Kobe Bryant? Penny would have come up 100 out of like almost 100%.
I just find there's a lot of stars that give their markets a ton of time to build around them. And if they don't, how are we going to tell Dwight Howard stay in Orlando the rest of your career? I lived in Detroit when Grant Hill left at 27. They didn't do it. They didn't do a good job building around him. So, and that's another one.
I just care if guys leave and go. Like, I hate the lifting of the veil that we got where it was like Draymond Green was in his car texting Kevin Durant. It's like, okay, I don't need you guys to be mortal enemies. I realize that we're never going to have Bill Laimbeer and Larry Bird hating each other so much that even when they go to an All-Star game, they're cussing each other out. But I also don't want to know you guys are best buddies and you're like,
but that's probably
planning
there's
to
probably
be
already been Paul George contact that we'll know about 11 and a half months.
You don't think Paul George is talking with his buddies and like Chris Paul's feeling out? Dude, all these guys play on USA Basketball together. They all played AAU together. They're all rich, popular athletes. Like, remember Tom Brady talking about how him and Peyton Manning have a relationship because there's not many people who do what they do? That's like NBA stars. Who are they going to relate to? Other NBA stars. Who do they grow up knowing? Other NBA stars.
I just always feel, and we'll finish on the Raptors in a sec, but I always feel there's a scenario where we don't remember when teams and players tried this and it didn't work out. Grant Hill goes to Orlando at 27. Mm-hmm. McGrady goes the same summer, and he's 21 because he was so young, but he left after 3 years in Toronto.
Almost got Duncan.
And they wanted, so if that happens, and Grant was hurt, McGrady never got out of the first round. Never.
Which is crazy.
Which is nuts. I watched him and Orlando lead 3-1 against Detroit the year Detroit made the conference finals and lost to New Jersey with a not very good Jason Kidd and Keith Van Horn team and Kerry Kittles. Oh, my God. Anyway, but that had that worked, we wouldn't have even been near as critical. I still think LeBron comes utterly down to the decision, and it was horrible optics, and it was a hugely wrong thing from the get-go. I didn't even need to see it. When someone told me this is what he was doing, I said, this is such an utter mistake. There's no way to
parade.
And then it's 10 times worse with Jim Gray and the kids there and all that crap, and it made it way, way... And I never thought he'd recover from it. He almost needed JD to lose that first year for people to have empathy for him again. I felt sorry for him, and I didn't understand why he played so badly.
Well, not only that, I think that the Warriors becoming super team help, too. Maybe I'm remembering this wrong, but I do feel like last year, most people were still cheering for the Warriors against the Cavs.
And you've seen a public... like, what have you seen with... with the Warriors, in that they've gone from very likable, especially with Kerr when he took over. I think Mark Jackson felt that way when he was there. And people like the players. They love the style. now there's an obnoxiousness to it. Even Steph Curry, who's really likable, I think he gets leeway with some people. Other people have closed that door on the leeway, and they're like, he was getting criticized for being cocky, criticized for taking a nap, criticized for taking a dump on the whatever. He's getting criticized for stuff that he would not have got criticized for 2 years ago.
But that's what I mean, is that the Warriors have
They're obnoxious now.
Well, they've helped LeBron James become, a sympathetic hero, I think, more than his loss to Dallas. Because we love that Dallas win. That's the win we all point to where we're saying, like, that's what you do. Yeah. You do a Dirk Nowitzki, you rough it out with your franchise, and you keep grinding away. And if you're an all-time great, you find a way to be great, and that's what Dirk did. And he had his own flu game, remember?
Yeah.
Against the Heat. And that's the sterling example of you just need one star to get hot for one series, and they can do it, even though, Jason Terry was incredible for them, Kidd was good for them. Anyway, all that aside, the Warriors are the villains now. And it's because Kevin Durant went there, and the Warriors basically made it like, what's the big deal? Like, so what? We got Kevin Durant. Like, he wanted to be here, and he's like, he wants to win, and we're not assigned anything. And then when they go into games, they're lighting teams up, and they're being super arrogant, and then their owner, Joe Lacob, is saying, we're light years ahead of teams. Like, oh, give me a break. Like, you had an idiot general manager, Pat, take two point guards before Steph Curry. Yet another idiot, notorious bad franchise, take Jimmer Fredette before Klay Thompson. Draymond Green falls to the second round. That's great job by you. But ultimately, like, it's a franchise that has a lot of luck, and they act like they're doing something so completely different, and that they shouldn't be viewed as supervillains, that there's some type of unfair projection on them by the rest of the league. And that's why I think people get pissed off. And now LeBron is like the savior, which is he's never been in his entire career.
We're going to call Carol and Cameron in Vancouver in a little bit. You can stay with me because I feel awkward talking, just having any conversation with her.
I don't think you're allowed.
Chemistry's really stilted.
Okay. I was going to say.
Well, that's true too.
Is she in Vancouver because she's looking at other job opportunities?
Okay. She is, or I am.
She's doing other
I'm looking
podcast.
For their podcast. Okay. She's looking for their podcast co-host.
What's she doing? What does she want to talk about?
Being out in Vancouver, she sends pictures. She brags about how cool it is to watch sports out there. You know what it's. I've never lived on the West Coast. My few trips I've gone for like NHL series or NFL or whatever. I love the earlier start for sporting events.
Has she been waiting as long as I waited to get on?
Yeah. Well, apparently now. Yeah, there's been a delay. So did anything? We'll wrap the NBA with this, but anything from the end of the Raptors sweep to the Cavs to now make you feel any different if you could advise Masai about, or if you were a player, if you were Lowry, if you were Ibaka, you watched the last 4 weeks of basketball, does it make you feel any different about being in Toronto, not being in Toronto? What does it make you feel?
No, I think if I'm Kyle Lowry, I'm considering Philadelphia. Philadelphia is very real to me because they're going to get a top three pick. They could end up with Malik Monk.
You could hit all these players maybe in their prime. You could hit Simmons, Embiid, if they can still
Simmons,
healthy.
Embiid. But the only thing with Lowry is that Embiid's health is a question mark. We haven't seen Simmons yet, even though Simmons is going to win Rookie of the Year next year, Greg. Like, that's going to happen. He's a really, really good player.
Ball couldn't win?
I don't think so. I think it's going to be Simmons. I think he's.
I wonder if
really,
a star
really
goes
good.
To L.A. and he's there.
Yeah, but the thing is, that Ball is going to have to compete for minutes with D'Angelo Russell as of right now, unless a trade happens. Like, there's Clarkson there, there's Russell there, and it's going to be Ball.
Well, you know what a big fan of Ohio State guards I am.
Yeah.
I mean, Michael Redd, Scoony Penn. I still think Scoony Penn.
Actually, Michael Redd, I really liked.
He was a hell of a college
And also,
player.
Don't diss Mike Conley, who's one of the probably better players.
Oh, no. I'm almost forgetting Mike Conley.
But I think that there's still a little bit too much risk for that for Kyle Lowry. Like, I don't think that there's a certain championship there, right? Like, do you think LeBron James window... Like, he's older than LeBron, so...
No, and when he looks in Toronto, like, I wonder... Here's what I'd say. This would be a really interesting year if DeMar DeRozan was up this year and not last year.
Sure.
What would he do? Would he then be thinking Lakers because they have a number two overall pick? Would he then be thinking, I can grow old? You always want to grow old with younger people around
DeMar. I think he's just that type of loyal guy who always wanted to be a Toronto Raptor and has his family here. And I don't think LA ever intrigued him that much, to be honest. Because think about how fast the meeting happened with the Raptors.
Well,
like,
the rumors,
a done deal.
But the rumors didn't hurt him. I mean, that's out there for a reason.
Yeah, but he didn't
not
take
the DeMar,
a meeting
not the DeMar
with
and
the
his camp are leaking. No, but it's not the worst thing in the world to have people speculating that you'd love to be somewhere else and you'd be a great fit somewhere else. That happens in our business. Not
I guess,
that we're leaking
but
stuff
it wasn't
about you
like
me,
it wasn't like if DeMar DeRozan left, or if it wasn't like if DeMar DeRozan didn't re-sign with the Raptors right away, that a bunch of teams wouldn't have lined up to have meetings and consider him.
And what
like
about
he wasn't starting a fake bargain or A fake bartering war. Bartering war.
He was on Melky Cabrera's fake website. Now, what about Ibaka? Because you look at him, and I think if you went around the ACC and you go, how old is that guy? How old has he been around? And some people might say 30, 31. He's 27.
Mm-hmm.
There might, and yet he looks like an older 27.
Yeah,
you know, in a strange way. What do we do?
I thought Ibaka was going to be able to turn it around a little. I thought that him being in Orlando was a bit of the reason why he had slowed down defensively. Like, we got a couple. I'll admit, like, I don't really tune into a lot of Orlando Magic games throughout the year, but when they did play the Raptors, he seemed to elevate his game a little bit, and he looked really good. There was one game in particular. It was the one where they were actually sitting Kyle Lowry, they were sitting Corey Joseph. And they were saying, like, hey, we're punishing you for your bad play, and you're going to sit for a while. And Serge Ibaka was incredible in that game. I remember thinking, this is a guy that's, like, his defensive numbers are shrinking because the team around him is god-awful. Like, there's nobody there. But Orlando was supposed to be a great defensive team this year. That was the one thing they were supposed to have.
Right.
And, you know, he was a step slower this year. He wasn't blocking as many shots. He wasn't as good defending up to the perimeter. He's still kind of a sucker for taking bad shots. Like, think about all the ones that he took with the Raptors against the Bucks in that series where it was like, and even the Cavs where they baited him into those.
The playoffs
long
were
twos.
Hard to judge because they Cleveland shot the lights out. Toronto didn't defend the three very well. And Toronto, I don't want to excuse their bad 3-point selection. So do you look at Ibaka's regular season? He played 23 regular season games here, shot basically 40% from three. Do you say some of the shots even within three were bad choices, bad timing, not good looks for him?
Yeah, I think with Ibaka, like, I'm on the Raptors should re-sign Ibaka bandwagon because it's like, okay, well, what else are you
going to
do?
What's the alternative?
Like, what's your alternative? There's going to be a bunch of teams that are tanking anyways. You can't just strip it down to the root. Like, there's enough good things here. You don't rip apart a team that's won 50 games the last 3 years and had the success they had just because you're saying, okay, well, let's just try something new. I think you do go with a different coaching approach. So bring back Ibaka because he represents a little bit more of the modern NBA, this pace and space that you want to play. He can do that. He can be a five in the new NBA, at least for now. If you end up getting burned a little bit on the back end of the contract, so what? Same thing with Kyle Lowry. I'm all in on that.
Fans want a ring, but if you and I were in MLSA meetings, we'd want six home playoff dates.
Sure.
So getting none is awfully impactful.
And not only that,
you're spending the same amount on the salary.
But they've also shown a propensity to be able to find certain guys later in the draft and be able to develop them into at least something. Like, Norm Powell has been a big hit.
Yeah.
Like, a really big hit. And Poeltl, we'll see. Siakam, we'll see. I don't know if Siakam over McCaw is going to look all that good in a couple of years. But there's going to be some stuff. The one question mark for me is DeRozan. Because Masai Ujiri keeps saying in the end of the season press conference, like, we got to change the way we play. We've tried playing no more iso ball,
no more hero ball.
But I look at DeMar and I say, I don't really see how he changes. It's not even about the three-point shot. He could become a creator, right? He could become a guy that handles the ball and finds other guys and gets into traffic and still generates free throws, but ultimately doesn't take as many long twos or bad possessions or late in the shot clock before the ball starts to move. I just don't think he's that guy.
How many guards in the league are better at slashing to the basket, not pulling up for jumpers, and not pulling up because he can't shoot the three? Well, he has to go inside.
But
and how many guys
mean?
Slash? No, and how many guys slash and shoot free throws with the consistency and the propensity that he does? Not many.
No, he's an excellent player, and I'm not saying he's not. He's got a very, very desirable skill set. He's probably an underrated player. I would actually say that in terms of my doubting of whether he can evolve his game, this has happened before and he's burned me. Because it was always like, well, can DeMar DeRozan get to the line more? Yes. Can DeMar DeRozan improve his handle? Yes. He's constantly come out and developed something every single offseason. Can he get a little stronger? Yes. He's always done it. I don't think that if you're the Raptors, yes, you can keep winning probably without DeMar DeRozan as of right now. You could slide Norm Powell in and be your two. You could draft another guy. And you're at least starting to cultivate the whole, like, hey, we're going to move more into a modern-style NBA play. I think as long as you have DeMar DeRozan, there's a question mark anyways that you're going to be able to move into the new era.
We better call Carolyn Cameron.
Let's do it.
All right. And so you're not with us on the podcast this week, and you're out in Vancouver. Is it a second home? Is that what you'd still call it? Do you still feel beloved there?
I still love it here. Yeah, I'd call it a second home. It's good to be back. It's been really bad weather, though, which is not really a surprise, but it's raining right now.
I was going to say it must be raining because why else would you come on and do this podcast on off day? Like, are you so threatened?
Jamie's trying to take over. Right?
I was going
to
say, are you very threatened by my presence here? Because this seems like a little bit of like a, you're like, oh, no, I'll make myself available. Like, don't worry, I'll be here.
But now I am.
I know exactly. Now I put it in your head. So what do you even do? Like, I think you're like a big outdoors person. right? You like to do the outdoorsy things?
Yes, I've gone on some hikes since I've been back. I was going to hopefully jog along the seawall if I can today. No, just visiting. It's been great watching sports here, though. I mean, I got here in the middle of the Jays and Seattle series, so I forgot how nice it is to watch sports earlier in the day.
Oh, it's the best part about living out west. The only thing that sucks is when it's 7 o'clock games and it's a weekday and you're like, okay, well, I'm not even off work. In this industry you are. This is what you do. But if in other walks of life, if you're someone that works a 9 to 5, guess what? The game you want to watch is starting at 7 o'clock.
Right.
Or 4 o'clock.
Noon Eastern game.
Mm-hmm.
But I would think productivity. It's like, what have we had? 3, 4, 5 ALDS or ALCS games here that have started at 1 or 3 o'clock, and people just bugger off. But there's only so many days in every, not just in the sports business, but that ceases product. We're more productive on the East. You couldn't have Wall Street in Portland, Oregon.
No,
you couldn't. People would leave.
I completely agree with that. Yeah, the pace of life here is a bit slower.
Wow, shots fired to the West Coast. Hey, you lazy bums. Why don't you get on the stock exchange, you idiots?
Become a day trader. What's the matter?
What's going on over here? Okay, so basically you went to BC to exercise?
No, I'm here. Okay. I'm here for the charity golf tournament. It was yesterday. It's for Challenger Baseball, so that all kids can play baseball. So, yeah, it's an awesome event. So I was out here hosting that golf tournament. I hosted with James Cebulski, actually.
You host a golf tournament? You have your own golf tournament?
Isn't that amazing?
No, it's a charity golf tournament, and I volunteer to host.
But it's a matter of time. The Carol and Cameron Classic,
I was gonna say,
to use alliteration, is on its way. It's in development.
Because I was going to say, that's really good. When you get to Mark Spector level of hosting your own golf tournament, then you know you've made
Spector
it.
Spector has his own golf tournament.
Yeah, Spec has his own golf tournament. You know what, though? I will say this.
It's in Alberta.
There's a shocking amount of sports media people that have golf tournaments.
I know what you mean.
Yeah, it's like, I remember sitting in Jay's press box once and sitting behind a certain guy from TSN as he edited his website for his golf tournament, and I was like, good God, like, who's paying a lot of money to go to this guy's golf tournament? Who even volunteers to go other than TSN personalities? But that's okay. You never know. I'm always shocked that when we have those contests at Sportsnet where it's like I saw you at Jay's Care, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're bidding away.
Oh, who didn't?
Ivanka kept putting you on the spot. You're like, all right, let's do this. Let's make a little joke here. I was like, oh, good job.
Can't be trusted.
Yeah, I know. That was a tough one for you. But I did think there was the experience with Zahn and Jamie Campbell.
Oh, those things go for big money.
I know. It's insane, though, because I just picture the people, and they go in the booth, and they're like, hello. And they're like, hey, where are you from? What do you do? Well, it's nice to meet you. And then you leave, and you go into the radio booth, and you see them, and it's like, hello, nice to meet you. And then you're like, wow, that was $5,000.
I know, but you're thinking of it from our perspective, where that's our job.
Maybe. I don't know.
Well, you know how
way to undersell, JD.
I better get. We'll cut this part.
They have those numbers. So with two non-married people, this is easy. They have those numbers where you know at a certain point in time on a first date whether you're going to have a second date. Golf is like that too. But think you've got 5 hours potentially in a cart with a stranger or someone you just met, and you're like, you know, within maybe a hole and a half. But I think there's some evolution time whether you'll ever want to play golf with that person again. Or you ever will not, or you're like, how am I getting through the next 16 and a half holes and the next 75 to 85 shots?
Did someone bid to play with you?
No, you just get paired with a random group. My group was good. It was a bunch of guys who work for the McDonald's office here in Vancouver. I think it's in Burnaby, they said, because that was the title sponsor of the tournament. They were a nice group of guys, though, but you're right. We were together for about 6 hours.
Yeah,
the charity golf tournaments usually go a bit slower, too, because each hole has something and...
Oh, special little bidding things and contests.
Can I tell?
Yeah, to try and get your score to be better and things like that. I'm not a very good golfer. I've only golfed a handful of times in my life.
I thought you lived on a golf course.
I've never lived on a golf course.
Oh, I was wrong. I thought you were living on a golf course.
She's tennis through and through.
No, I just, okay, sorry. It's the other country club sport that you were big time into. Yeah, the other rich person sport. Yeah. that's fun. My bad. That's my bad. I went to a charity golf tournament, not as a guest, but as reporting and meeting people at Greg Zahn's charity golf classic. And
oh my gosh, what's that like?
It was pretty cool. Damon Allen was there. There was a bunch of other celebrities there. But the big one that I was down to actually interview was Jake Gardner. It was his rookie year, and he was really popular, if you remember. And he no-showed. And I felt really terrible because... there was this lady that had clearly bid for Jake Gardner, and she's sitting there with her Maple Leaf golf shoes and her Maple Leaf golf covers and her Maple Leaf cap, and Jake Gardner doesn't show up. And instead of putting someone else with her that's a celebrity, of course you can't do that, it'd be other people bid for them. The Zonterage bunnies, I believe there were, they unloaded a bus.
Oh, no.
There was three girls that were like early 20s. This lady's probably like 55, 60, and three young girls that are probably like 20, 21. I don't know what they do in their other time of not being Zonterage bunnies, but they just like hop on her cart, be like, we'll keep you company today. I was like, I'm pretty sure she would just rather golf alone. I don't think that she really wants to spend 18 holes with you three 20-year-olds being like, yay, great shot, Norris. Like, that was, I was like, what a nightmare for her. Like, she went from golfing with a Toronto Maple Leaf to her worst nightmare in the span of an hour. Like, tough break for Norris.
JD's suggesting that there's more time in a day if you are a bunny. It's not. It is grinding it out for 18, 19.
It's literally grinding it out.
No, that's not like a Raptors dance pack member who's also like an accountant. That's not to say you can't pull it off.
Yeah, usually
you only
when
have 41
it's
home
usually
games.
When it's 40 girls getting off of a bus to the Zon tournament. I don't think there was a lot of accountants in the group.
So okay, so the Jays do the Seattle
not to be
thing.
A jerk.
There must be now. JD's a born and bred Seattle Mariners fan. There must be. Here's what I wonder about Vancouver: are there not Mariners fans that are quiet in Vancouver and they live in pockets and they're American League? And if they ever met in an ALDS, they'd all of a sudden like come out of the shadows and show their true colors and have their like aquamarine faces painted. Are there not Mariners? It is the second most popular team there.
Yeah, and I would say it's a generational thing. So
yeah, I
agree. Because it used to be about a I don't know when it came off air here, but about a decade ago, you were able to get every local Mariners game on TV. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people watched that. And then I feel like when the Jays rebranded and went back to kind of their old logo and old roots and then, of course, started winning, it's now a lot of young people are Jays fans. So I want to say, like, 50 and under.
So they're rejecting their parents' ideals about Ken Griffey and Randy Johnson and Edgar Martinez.
No, but that's the thing. Just look at the people that are in the stands.
Yeah.
Yeah, you see a ton of Jays hats around Vancouver.
Yeah.
But you also see Mariners hats. But, yeah, it's more a generational thing. Because even when I went to Jays in Seattle series, I guess 2 years ago, it is honestly, there's hardly any Mariners fans.
Well,
crazy.
Let's be honest, too. The Jays at the trade deadline, like a whole bunch of people jumped on the bandwagon. And then they got a lot of national attention because it looked like they were going to be a title contender for the next couple of years. They were very exciting. They were hitting a lot of home runs. They got David Price. That was unbelievably a sexy move. It got a lot of attention. It's in the middle of a downtime where nothing else is happening and it'll be trade deadline day. Like, I think the thing we moved off of, Greg, we were doing a show together at the time.
Yeah.
The thing we moved off of was Masai Ujiri in doing Giants of Africa. And that was the most interesting thing we could do that day, having him from wherever he was.
We canceled Masai Ujiri
that
day.
Yeah,
we did.
Yeah, we canceled Masai Ujiri. But I think that, Carolyn's got it right on the head. Like, it's been a long time since Griffey. It's been a long time since the 01 Mariners. And there's been a long period. Like, the Mariners are the longest team that have the longest playoff drought in baseball right now. There's a lot of malaise in that fan base. It's like, all right, great. They've had some great players like Ichiro and Felix Hernandez in the time. But mostly it's been a lot of disappointing signings, a lot of bad managers, a lot of lack of success or missing out and watching the other teams in the division find great players and go on good runs. And the Jays, as of now, for a baseball market, if you're a baseball fan and you're in Vancouver and you've just watched losing after losing after losing from both the Jays and the Mariners, who had the two longest streaks, it was basically a race to see who was going to be great first, and the Jays beat them to the punch, and they branded as a national team, and they kind of took over that market. And now I don't think it is a Mariners market. I think it would, honestly, it's probably going to take another generation of a really good Mariners team to steal people back in that area.
I think we're naive to think, too, that anywhere in Canada, I think in Toronto it's easy to think that, okay, you're in Toronto, so you're going to cheer for the Jays, you're going to cheer for the Raps, cheer for the Leafs, and I get that. Cheer for the Raptors. I get that in Toronto, but in other places in Canada, people also just cheer for people from their town or from their province. So here, I think a lot of people were cheering for Ryan Dempster when he was with the Red Sox, right? Mm-hmm. Like, good BC boy.
Larry Walker,
A lot of people on the island cheer for the Ben brothers from Vancouver Island.
Yeah, but the Mariners have Paxton.
Yeah, I think especially in BC and other parts of Canada outside of Toronto, it's more a loyalty to your city or province.
So you're out there. Tell us the low ebb of the Canucks' expectations. We've seen it in Toronto. It is, Luke Fox came on this morning, and we're like, here's the one team Vegas, no matter who they pick, could finish ahead of. Vancouver. Like there, there is, and then it'll be like Toronto 3 years ago. How many people want wins? How many people are like, will you just give us three top three draft picks in a row so we can do this better than we've been doing it? Is that the feeling in Vancouver, British Columbia?
Yeah, I think the feeling's the same that it's been for the past few years, where they're kind of stuck. There doesn't seem to be a direction of a clear rebuild, and you can't really have a clear rebuild until the Sedins have moved on, and you also can't realistically move those contracts. So it's just kind of sit and wait and try and get as many good draft picks as you can in the next few years and then hope it turns a corner. But the thing with the Canucks is for years, really since 2 years removed from the Cup final in 2011, they've wanted to make the playoffs while also try and rebuild without saying it, and you can't have it both ways.
So I guess that's what you're doing on your runs and on your hikes. You're just pulling up next to people and be like, how are you feeling about the Canucks next year? They're like, please leave me alone. I have my headphones in. No, but do you think that this people are going to sour on the Sedins, though, a little bit? Because you mentioned you can't have a true rebuild until they're gone.
Well, they have 1 year left. So what do you do when they're 37 and they're free agents?
No, but that's what happened with
summer.
Matt Sundin. He had 1 year left. And if you would have told most Leafs fans 2 years before or a year before, heading even into that season,
you won't see him again.
You're going to sour on Sundin this year. You're going to get mad. So they end up in a trade deadline spot, and you have these two assets that if you split them apart would be actually worth something, would really help your rebuild. But everyone's pretty much accepted like, hey, no, you can't trade these guys. They won't go play on a different teams. It has to be one group with these two dudes. I feel like it at least does have the potential where Canucks fans are going to be like, you know what? Screw these guys.
No, I don't think so. They're too ingrained in the city and the province. They're like the unofficial mayors. People love the Sedins. They're so likable. So I don't think anyone's going to go against them. And I think with having a new coach in town this year, that'll help too, because that'll distract people from the start. And it'll change the Sedins' role. I mean, their role won't be as, I don't want to say important, but it won't be as vital as it has been in past years. I think
still
going to
rip up power plays. And
Yeah. So, no, I don't think anyone will go sour on them. I think it's just kind of still a waiting game. But Canucks fans are they're not the most patient. I mean, the issue with getting as far as they did in 2011 is then you get used to doing well. They had a number of good years with good teams, and now for a number of years it hasn't been good. Even though they made the playoffs a couple of years ago, it has not been good, and fans are not that forgiving.
So JD's got to head to the Walker show in a little bit, and I'm going to, work on my pecs or something, but, or we could switch around.
Awful.
Yeah, that was, and then I'm
cut
I'm,
that part too.
And then I'm, okay. JD needs to know I'm going to shower right after a workout. So I'm not walking around campus without showering.
I don't really
showering.
Feel like we need, or anyone needs to hear about your pecs and your showers. I actually kind of feel like.
I wish the showers had stayed private. It couldn't stay private.
I was going to say, I feel like. You should be careful with how you treat Carolyn, because all she has to do is clip some, like, this is audio. She just goes, I'll teach you how to use Burly, Carolyn. You go and you clip all the times Greg references his workouts and his showers, and you put it in a nice little compilation. You slide that USB key right under the HR's door. And guess what? Like, it's now just the Carolyn Cameron podcast. You can do whatever you want.
She gets what she wants.
Yeah, that's all you. If you ever want to, you ever want to mutiny or get your own thing going, like, just like, yeah, give me a shout. I'll show you how to use Burly.
I'll last as long
as you know how. You were a fan intern. I forgot that you were a fan intern.
One of the best. Are you kidding?
That actually felt a little bit like mansplaining.
It is. It was, so, radio, this is exciting, though. You're out there. You're going to go to a launch party today. I understand.
Oh, yeah.
At least partially catered. So JD and I are radio guys by nature.
I hope it is. I would assume
it's got to. You can't.
That's
not.
That's why I'm going.
It's not a bring your own bag. Lunch. It can't be a bring your own bag lunch. There's a lot of explaining to do.
I could see it being like little plates of hors d'oeuvres.
Like whatever they paid for the Canucks rights, they can pay like 2% of that for some sandwiches. But this is the launch party for Sportsnet 650. So JD and I love rumors, except when we're involved in them. Like, what do you think or who will be there? Because almost transport us to, you can't live tweet from it. Tell us what's happening.
I don't think there's going to be any. I mean, I'm usually last to know. I'm not really in the loop with things. I don't think they're announcing anything today. I think it's just a launch party for ad buyers to come
out. Oh, God. So sales weasels are like everywhere.
There's going to be food. Now there's food. Food is in the mix now. Don't eat. Don't eat, Carolyn.
Drink tickets and food. Oh, great.
Keep the metabolism going. Just little snacks throughout the day.
Yeah, I don't think they're making any big announcements.
No.
You know what?
Watch all the announcements be made by the time we post this podcast.
Can you do me a favor?
I'm just showing up for the food.
Yeah, okay. Can you do me a favor, though, and also this? Show up for the food, and while you're, like, eating at the trays, and people are coming over, and they're like, oh, are you Carolyn Cameron? Be like, yeah, hey, what's up? And be like, hearing a lot of buzz about J.D. Bunkus that coming in.
Yeah.
Hearing a lot of, like, a lot of traction, this guy. Like, have you heard of this guy? Like, basically, just pull one of those for me.
For overnights.
You been to Vancouver, J.D.?
Yeah, of course. I'm from out west.
Where are you from?
I'm from Wentworth, Yukon.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I lived in Victoria. I went to Campus View Elementary as a kid.
How little we know about each other. Yeah,
exactly. Oh, well, that's changing.
Shout out Campus View.
Wait.
You can head west then, JD.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what people are saying.
I can't lose it. We cannot lose
people
him.
Like Carolyn Cameron.
People like Carolyn Cameron are suggesting, sources close to the Camerons are suggesting that that's a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one way or the other. But it's, so this will be at like a TV building. This is the building you worked in. This is where they're moving.
No, it'll be at Rogers Arena, I think.
Oh my God.
Bar.
Oh, the party will be there.
But
for a second, I thought you meant the radio station. I was like, oh my God.
Behind the scenes pictures.
Hmm.
Of the food platters.
Are you allowed to do that? You're not going to sign a confidentiality agreement?
Yeah. That's true.
I think the food's safe.
Yeah.
All right, probably. And when do you come back? When do you settle back in? When do we look for you on evenings or late night or the morning run with?
I'm back to work Monday.
And who are you anchoring with?
Ken. Ken Reed all that week for the rest of June.
Back in the big seat, the big show.
Don't worry, I'll be back next week. Maybe you can leave.
No more staying up till 3 a.m. Actually, that's the other thing people are talking about. They're talking about JD on the desk. I don't know. There's a little bit of buzz flying around. Toby's been looking for people. Like, it's thin. It's a thin crew these days. No you, no Ivanka. Like, I got to step up. I'm working on my packs, working on my reads, my VOs. I'm ready.
They do need people in the summer.
Yeah, I'm ready.
I'm hearing you at the desk and in Vancouver.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And okay.
Well, we could just do, like, I have seen, like, I'm pretty sure the other guys have like a million people for the desk, because every time I ever see their show, there's people I've never seen before.
They do have a lot of people, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, look out, Leo Rowdens. I mean, you know, Eric Smith didn't play the game. So, I mean, right there.
We will cut that too.
All right. We'll be editing that.
Yeah, there's a lot of cuts to be made. Probably about 35 minutes of cuts from Dallas Aikens.
I feel like Dallas Aikens won't air until later in the summer. I think we may have enough just with the two segments that we've done. And JD didn't bring any stories for What Up With That. Like, this is
nothing.
The fine.
What's up
he's not
that?
Treading on you. Interesting stories.
Hours.
By the way, we'd get you to comment on Milos Raonic having a new coach, but by the time the podcast airs, I'm not sure Mark Knowles will still be his coach. So,
man, you guys must be excited that the real sports are over, so you can just point take and be like, point. What Milos Raonic's new coach?
They got a great field for the Aegon Championships, which used to be the Stella Artois. That's
I think Milos Raonic's new coach is going to be all about tighter strings on the racket. How do you respond? Yes. Go back to wood. No more fiberglass wussy stuff. Wood racket only for Milos.
I got to go back to Dallas Aikens. Did you talk exercise with him and biking?
We got into a bit of that. All he said was,
Greg
"I said
talked about his pecs a lot."
I did. Well, you're talking about your pecs, and I'm not allowed to talk about my pecs. So that's not right. But he did say, "Don't eat a croissant at any time of day." I was like, before 6 a.m., after 9 p.m., he said, "Don't eat any croissants. It's just empty calories."
Legitimately going to go get one right when I get off the phone.
And I didn't ask him about your avocado toast because it's killing him. It's not only the real estate in California where he is, but the millennials and you know all your home buying aspirations and your avocado toast.
Avocado's good fat. He would have told you good fat.
I ate is the like 12 powdered donuts I ate after the Blue Jays game at 12 last night. Good fat
or Taco Bell.
No, I'd
say that's bad fat.
Hmm.
He wouldn't have mixed well with the McDonald's guys that you played golf with. He would have been questioning a lot about their healthy menus, choices, and what goes into those milkshakes and all that stuff. It would not have gone well.
I wish, you know what would have been funny that you blew it with Dallas Aikens?
How long it was?
No, that for sure. But all you needed to do was bring in our boy Brent Gunning and have Brent tell Dallas Aikens his regimen of what he eats in a day.
Ew, what does he eat? great.
No, well, it's insane. I don't really want to, like, I should have, we have to cut this. We'll say unnamed Sportsnet employee. This part gets cut. Let's just start again. Unnamed Sportsnet employee told me that he doesn't eat anything all day. Like, he just doesn't eat.
But then,
like,
he has one giant meal.
Yes, and then he
bedtime.
Just gorges,
it's
basically,
sort of like, a cat.
Like, multiple meals.
Shouldn't it be the other way around? I'm not a nutritionist, but wouldn't you need, I mean, food is energy. Wouldn't you want to eat that meal in the morning?
I mean, I would think so. I tried it. Sometimes I'll admit I have had my moments where I'm bad with eating in the morning. You get up a little late and you're flying out the door, and then you realize, like, once you get into a couple of shows that it's 4 o'clock and you haven't eaten yet. But generally, I do try to get in some type of breakfast, get the metabolism going. But yes, for this individual, he just likes the evening feast.
Like, I feel like he eats like a cheetah. Like, he goes out on the African plains, catches one thing, eats it all at once, and then he's got to wait another 19 hours until he can catch a goat or an antelope
and,
or something.
And it's not surprising. Again, this is employee X, because we cut this part. Gets a little cranky at times. I'm like, maybe his blood sugar getting a little low during the day. You're just trying to get to the gorge.
But it's not like a cheetah, because there's food readily available to him.
I have to eat every couple hours, or else I get really weak.
Do you get? Well, we haven't seen you get cranky yet. The audience is waiting for
I've seen you get
cranking diva moment, and I don't think that's in you.
I've seen you be. I told you this before. I've actually, like, this would be a separate podcast, but this could be just a segment of there's not times you've been cranky, but this could be a separate segment of times that I was convinced Carolyn Cameron hated my guts. There's at least 20 times like this. I remember,
a text request to do Sports Tinder?
No,
would that have made her angry?
Yeah. No, actually, Carolyn was always very... she was always at a musical.
I'm just checking.
But I would say this. This will be my quick, like, time I was convinced Carolyn Cameron hated me. I ran into Carolyn at an establishment once, and it was a patio, and I wasn't, like, hoping to sit down with Carolyn by any stretch, but I was just like... later. But at first I came up to you. I saw you and your friend sitting down, and I just came over. I gave, like, the hi, and you just gave me, like, the, like, go away nod. I was like, all right. Yes, absolutely. I went, like, sat down, and I was like, wow. And my friends were like, do you know her? I'm like, no. I thought you were someone else. And then you did come over, and I was like, oh, I guess
it wasn't.
Yeah, it was. I didn't want to say where it was, because I didn't want to, like, have your loyal listeners all of a sudden showing up. We'll cut that, too. That part.
That's a lot getting cut. This will end up being about 7 minutes out of 25.
That was at unnamed Toronto establishment that you don't go to a lot.
Yeah.
No, exactly.
Yeah. But yeah.
I have a tendency. People have told me, though, I don't want to. I mean, I guess you can swear on podcasts, but I don't want to. But that I have a resting B face where I do look angry a lot of the time if I'm not smiling.
No comment.
I used to have to write in my on-cams on Sportsnet Central at the top, smile, so that I didn't look angry.
I was going
to
say, sometimes, like, again, that's even when I've been confused. Sometimes you smile doing something, I'm like, that's like a murderer's smile. Like, that's what, like, a murderer looks like right before.
Greg, we're done with
that. I think so, yeah. There's a microphone. I think technically.
We'll cut that part, too. That part's cut.
I forgot to hit record on all of this.
Yeah.
Okay, see ya.
You've been listening to Point Taken with Carolyn Cameron and Greg Brady on Sportsnet.ca/590.